A brief announcement, just to remind you, we have a good start on our Living Grace deal, but we have a believer wanting to move here for the purpose of getting face-to-face teaching, and of course, I'm down with that. So if you are inclined to apply, we don't know what the need will actually be at this point. We really won't know that probably till close to the end of August, but certainly keep it on your prayer list. That God will bless the whole situation, and if you are inclined to apply in that regard, please note on any offering that it is for that. Okay, let's make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here dealing with this incident, one of the first or second incidents really that Mark records following this large day at Capernaum in the synagogue. Where they come and find Peter's mother-in-law sick. And immediately, rereading our verses, after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew, accompanied by James and John. Now, Simon's mother-in-law had been lying sick with a fever. Again, the sense of the imperfect is, was sick. And immediately, they speak to Jesus about her. And having come to her and raised her up, having taken her by the hand, the fever left her, and she waited on them. And we're down here, left off here with point 11, so we're ready to resume with point 12. The imperfect indicative of the verb katakaimai indicates that this illness had been troubling Simon's mother-in-law for some time. Again, we don't know. I doubt that it was hours. I would assume it was more like days, because the issue here with the fever would demand infection. And that, as we know, with the bacterial aspect of it, is not only contagious, but creates fever as the body speeds up the enzyme process in order to fight off invaders. So 13, the fact that she was lying down is explained by the causal participle of pureso, which is a general term for fevers of any kind. And I would, again, translate that, she was lying sick because she had a fever. They've actually supplied the word sick there, although it's not in italics. But they've kind of supplied sick with a fever. So I would translate it, she was lying down because she had a fever. And we've all been sick and all had fever, and you know how bad you can feel. So 14, although Mark does not make any distinction, Luke informs us that she was suffering from a very high fever, which could indicate a potentially life-threatening infection. If you look in Luke 4:38, and this, of course, is the parallel synoptic passage with this. He got up and left the synagogue and entered into Simon's home. Now, Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever. And, of course, this is something Luke, being a physician, would make a note of, that it was not just, you know, an ordinary sickness, that this was serious. And he records the same thing, and they asked him to help her, and standing over her, he rebuked the fever, and it left her. Now, Mark does not record any of the verbal aspects of this. Mark just records the fact that he walked up to her, took her by the hand, and she lifted her up, and she walked. Luke says he rebuked the fever, and she immediately got up and waited on them. And also John 4:46. Here's a similar one. This is not a parallel. This is a different incident. Therefore, he came again to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And there was a royal official whose son was sick at Capernaum. And when he heard that Jesus had come out of Judea into Galilee, he went up to him and was imploring him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. And the point here, in verse 52 that I want to get at, is that he inquired of them the hour at which he began to get better. And they said to him, yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him. And so we know that this child was to literally at death's door. Now, we're not told that about Peter's mother. We're told, our mother-in-law, rather. We are told, however, that it was a significant infection and a significant fever. Well, 15, the public issue of the propriety of healing on the Sabbath does not come up until later in this book. Nevertheless, it is clear that Jesus is not concerned with Jewish legalistic conventions. Now, the reason it doesn't arise here is because this was done privately within a residence. This wasn't done publicly. Nobody knew about this except the people in the immediate room. No doubt the word about this spread, that Jesus had done this on a Sabbath, as people are prone to talk about it. If God does something great for you and really graces you out, you're prone to talk about it, or you should be. That's kind of a normal response. So I would have believed that anybody that knew about this would have probably told their friends, etc., etc., and word would have eventually filtered out that Jesus did this on the Sabbath. And I think the enemies of Jesus become aware of this because as we get into chapter 2, we're going to see that they're already looking for stuff. And my contention is that they already knew he was violating what they considered to be a propriety in these matters. So 16, the disciples had just witnessed the decisive display of Jesus over the power of the demon. And they would have been aware that Jesus had already healed others. And 17, therefore, it only makes sense that they would intercede with Jesus on this woman's behalf. 18, Jesus does nothing out of the ordinary. He approaches the place where she is lying, takes her hand, and assists her to her feet. At 19, at Jesus' touch, the illness was completely cured. Her temperature returned to normal, and she began to go about her business. This is the way I want to get well, by the way. there was no gradual or partial healing, dependent upon the quality or quantity of faith she possessed. This was an immediate and total restoration to health. 21, having demonstrated his authority over demons, Christ now proves he is more powerful than human sickness. And obviously, we don't know. Things had to change. Fundamentally, I would guess, things had to change for her at a cellular level. That this isn't just, you know, a coat of whitewash over it, and you feel better now. But that things had to return to absolute health. All of her processes, her bodily processes, returned to the way they were before she was sick. And so much so that one couldn't even know she had been sick. And again, we don't know for sure how long she had been lying there sick. But if she's got an infection and a really high fever, it's probably not just that day. It's probably been going on for some days. So, 22, it was the custom of the day for the matriarch of the household to serve important guests. And the inability of his mother-in-law to do so would have been an additional pressure on her. No woman, I don't think, would like this. You know, how you have important visitors coming over, and you're just sicker than a dog. And so you're laid up in bed, and someone's in your kitchen. Better not mess with my stuff in there. Women won't like that. So again, while it's not brought out here, it did occur to me that this woman would have been under some additional pressure in her soul, the most likely, of having to deal with this, aside from the sickness. Because this would have been viewed in some ways as a failure at hospitality. And all of us, you know, we're all under the obligation to show hospitality from the pastor right on down. That's part of the deal of the pastor's code of conduct and the deacon's code of conduct. And all believers are commanded to do so, to demonstrate hospitality as is appropriate. And so you want to be able to do so when it's time to do so. And you have some important guests, really important guests show up, and you're sicker than a dog. Well, that can't be fun. So 23, in spite of the fact that Mark is quite fond of the adverb euthus, immediately, he does not use it here to describe the healing, which puzzled me a little bit, because he uses it so often. But I've concluded, in most cases, many of the cases certainly, if not most, he's not really using it to mean immediately, in the sense of exactly at that next second. He's using it to advance his narrative. That's just his way of talking. That's just his vocabulary. However, Luke uses the term parakramon, which is essentially kind of a similar word, which means without delay or immediately, in his account, to record the fact that she began serving as soon as Christ raised her from her bed. 24, this means there were no residual effects of the severe illness she had been experiencing. No weakness, no dizziness, or even any struggle. It was as if she had never been sick in the first place. 25, we are not told specifically what she did to serve her guests. But many, and I would think probably most interpreters, suggest that it had to do with food preparation, which would have been exactly what you kind of would have expected. That you have this visiting. Jesus would have had to have been viewed as a visiting dignitary. Well, 26, some observations on this account. A, the first and most obvious observation is that Peter was married, which is necessary if one is to have a mother-in-law. Now, you can't have a mother-in-law without being married. It's just that simple. B, in spite of the Roman Catholic false doctrine and stupidity about Peter being the first celibate pope, he is never commanded to leave his wife, nor does he. As we saw there in 1 Corinthians, we saw that first session, 9:5, where Paul acknowledges that Peter was still married. And Corinthians was written in probably the mid-50s AD. And this is occurring circa 30 AD. Might even be, I don't think we're into 31 AD yet. We could be, but we could be even be towards the end of 30 AD. But at any rate, 30 years later, he's still married. So see, Peter appears to be a man of some means, and was possibly somewhat older than the other disciples. This may account for why he so often took the lead and often seems to be the spokesman for the disciples. Peter, it would appear to me, typically speaking, by the time they were 18 years of age, men were expected to be looking for marriage in the Jewish culture of that time, which would indicate, again, and it would appear that Peter's been married. That this isn't, you know, new news to anyone. It's not as though he just got married, it doesn't seem. And there's nothing in the text that would indicate that. So Peter appears to be, again, a man of some means. He appears to be older, maybe in his mid-20s, where the other disciples may only be 16 or 17, some of the younger ones. It would appear that Matthew, as we're going to see, was probably older and more educated than these other men. And so, again, one of the things you see, or we're going to see, is that there was a real cross-section among the disciples. They weren't all men from one call of life or from one part of life or of one age or of one economic status or any of this. They varied in what they had and what they did and what they knew and how much money they made and all these other factors, how much overt prosperity they had, which, of course, Jesus calls them to just abandon and follow him. Now, it doesn't appear that Peter sold his house or any of that stuff. I mean, it appears that they all maintained their possessions. But their life obviously changed pretty dramatically when they began to follow Jesus full time. Well, D, Peter applied the appropriate doctrine toward his wife's aged mother. Although that was not as unusual in that time as it might be today. Although, having rethought about because of the Corban gimmick, it may have been unusual even in that time. It doesn't appear to have been as unusual. People seem to have understood it, that this was the way it should be. And so the fact is, though, Peter is applying doctrine already. And I mean, and so these qualities that these men have, when you start really to dig into this and you look at them, they weren't just a bunch of numbskulls out there that didn't know anything. They had, first, obviously, Jesus could read their positive volition. He could see what we can. Jesus was not some sort of a traveling healer, but a man with power and authority to deal with each situation he encountered. He did not use the same formula at all times, but responded to the needs he met as he was led to do so by the Holy Spirit. His healings were often accomplished with only a word or a touch. They were not characterized by ostentatious or elaborate displays. You don't see Jesus drawing attention to himself, screaming at the top of his lungs, doing a dance, a voodoo dance around the woman to get her up. You don't see any of these kinds of things. I had seen someone, I'd been a long, long time, but I got to see Ernest Angley again the other day. That guy's still alive. He looks like he's dead, but he's still alive. And he goes out and carries on and does all these, you know. I listened to his teaching as long as I could, but then when I started throwing up, I had to stop. I said, I'd be better getting drunk than listening to this. His healings were instantaneous and complete. They weren't partial. They didn't have to be, you know, okay, now go see the doctor. And once Jesus healed you, you were healed. Jesus healed indiscriminately and without cost, as we will see in the following verses. This contrasts all this, well, as we're going to see, with what goes on today, or and has gone on, quote, in the name of Christianity and the gospel over the years of the church age. Jesus healed dangerous and debilitating conditions. He cured organic diseases, and his cures were verifiable. Again, Peter's mom could have been suffering a life-threatening situation. We don't know. With a high fever like that, if it goes on unabated, I mean, if you get a fever up in the 104, 105 degree range, if it lasts very long, you're going to be in trouble. Your body's literally going to burn up the enzymes in it that are designed to keep you going. So while the initial stages of a fever are designed to produce enzyme activity, too long a fever and too high a fever will actually start killing the enzymes in your body. So Jay here compared this to modern healers who request or demand donations. You don't see Jesus with his hand out. I mean, he put his hand out to raise her up, but he didn't have his hand out like, here, give me some money. You know, he wasn't Jerry Maguire, show me the money. So compare this to modern healers who request or even demand donations, who cure heart palpitations or headaches, who only operate in a very controlled environment and who fail if the faith of the sick person is not great enough. How many times have I heard that one? Well, it wasn't successful because their faith wasn't right. Oh, really? Well, Jesus didn't walk up to this woman and say, do you have faith? Do you know who I am? None of that. He just walks up to her and heals her. And so, again, he lengthened my leg. My one leg was an eighth inch shorter. Well, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I don't know. How are you going to verify that, though? And you see the kinds of things that they heal. And again, Jesus' healing was instantaneous. I've watched Ernest Angley. I saw him say, baby. Baby! Say, baby.
Baby.
Say baby. Baby. And then eventually the guy gradually gets better. That seems kind of staged to me. I don't know. Well, Jesus, obviously, his wasn't staged. He didn't say, now how are you feeling? He didn't ask after the fact, are you better? He knew she was better. So, okay, as we will continue to observe, Jesus did not make any demands of those he healed. He did not demand that they have a certain amount of faith, that they accept him as Messiah, believe in him, or support his ministry. He made none of those deals. This was all freely. This was all grace. It was done freely. There were no strings attached. There is no permanent gift of healing. All who claim the ability to heal are charlatans. This is a person who makes a lot elaborate, fraudulent, and often verbose claims to skill or knowledge. A quack or a fraud. So they're charlatans, and sometimes worse. Why? Because some of these people may actually even be demon-possessed. We know that demon possession was pretty rampant in Jesus' day, as he dealt with it as he ran across it. We know it's going to be even more so from the prophecies of the last days, which indicate that demon activity is at an all-time high, particularly with relation to our nation. And it won't really matter what the demons are doing. A few more weeks in the Gulf and we'll all be underwater with oil. So, and those that make such claims often misinterpret the scriptures for their own purposes. In many, if not most or all cases, simply to make money. These ministries, when you go out and examine them, are all about the money. 1 Peter 2:24. Well, I'm not sure what that one's about. Oh, I know why. Okay. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross. And there's a purpose in that, so that we might die to the STA and live according to righteousness. For by his, and the word here actually, the word is bruise. By his bruise. And what's in view in the bruise? This takes you right back to Genesis. This talks about the bruising of the head and the bruising of the heel. And the bruising of Jesus' heel was his crucifixion and the bearing of sins, the spiritual death. By his spiritual death you were healed. Healed of what? Organic disease? No. If that's true, then I'm really in trouble because I'm still kind of sick. No, obviously you didn't heal. You've been sick, haven't you? So obviously that's not what he healed us of. And this is the verse they will turn to very often and try to shove down your throat. So by his wound, by his bruise, by his spiritual death on the cross, you were healed. Healed of what? And what healing is in view? Well, it's my contention that it's spiritual healing. At least the potential for salvation, phase one. And obviously Peter's writing to believers, so he knows they've already got that. He knows that they've been, quote, healed, phase one, by belief in the gospel. But this word doesn't mean necessarily physical healing. And this is the verse they will point to. So, you know, as Jesus was stripped and beaten and the blood fell, I mean, I've heard it all before. And as he bled, that blood heals you. That one South Park I watch, you got to hear Cartman preach. It's just funny. Yes, friends. I'm here to lead you into the wilderness. Well, why are these people doing it? Well, very often it just gets back down to money. Follow the money and you can find out a lot of stuff about things. Well, and although there was a great outpouring of miracles and healings in Jesus' ministry that carried over to some extent to the apostles in the early church, the biblical evidence indicates that the supernatural ability to heal gradually and fairly quickly disappeared. By the writing of the book of Philippians, Philippians 2, 26 and 27, by that time, and this is circa 60 AD, so this would be about 30 years after we are talking here about what's going on with Jesus. I mean, Jesus still has another couple of years of public ministry left. Philippians 2, 26 and 27, he's talking about Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow soldier. So this is one of Paul's close confidants and close supporters. In fact, a man that Paul trusts very much. Who is your messenger? He represented the church at Philippi. He was a go-between for Paul and the Philippians. And minister to my need. He was the one, in fact, selected to send this financial contribution to Paul that he's delivering, and that is really the subject of this letter to the Philippians. When Paul's in a Roman prison, he comes and visits him and brings him this donation from the Philippians. Because he was longing for you all, and was distressed because you had heard that he was sick. For he indeed was sick to the point of death. But God had mercy on him, and not on him only, but on me also, so that I would not have sorrow upon sorrow. I mean, can you imagine, you're Paul, you're the apostle, and you're sitting here in this Roman prison, and at some level, Paul had figured out by now, he's under discipline, that didn't have to have gone this way. Paul had figured that out, just as any believer can get under divine discipline and figure it out and say, you know, it didn't have to go this way. I didn't have to go this way. And so here's Paul in prison, and he's got enough lupe on his own soul because of what he's brought on himself. And then this guy comes from Philippi bringing this great financial gift, gets to Rome, gets sick, and dies on Paul's watch. Well, how would Paul feel about that? Not very good. You wouldn't feel good about that at all. But why didn't Paul, my question is, why didn't Paul just heal him? Because he couldn't. Do you think Paul would sit there and say, you know, I'm going to feel horrible if he dies, but I'm not going to heal him? No, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Paul didn't have the ability to heal him at this point. Now, did Paul have the ability to heal earlier in his ministry? Absolutely he did. That's easily documentable from the book of Acts. But does he have the ability to heal now? The scripture, in my opinion, suggests that he did not. Either that or Paul's a really cruel sucker. I'm sick, Paul, I'm dying. Too bad. I can heal you, but I'm not going to. Well, God, what kind of person would you be? How would you call yourself a minister of the gospel under those circumstances? And also 2 Timothy 4:20. Now, this one's written about 8 years later, roughly. This is written in late 67 or early 68 A.D. Maybe Paul was beheaded in the spring of 68 A.D. So this one's written either like late December or something of 67 or the early part of 68. 2 Timothy 4:20. Erastus remained at Corinth, but Trophimus I left sick at Miletus. Well, why would you do that if you could heal him? And to me, and this is where the details really begin to pile up and make the difference. If Paul had if Paul didn't have the ability to heal by that time, then that would largely suggest that no one else did either. The temporary gifts, as we know, were very short-lived in the angelic conflict. I don't think you can make a case for the temporary gifts much past 60 A.D. And maybe they were phased, but I think they were being phased out before that. And that's one of the things, if you see the doctrine of spiritual gifts, and I know it's lengthy, but it had to be to really address a bunch of the issues. But if you see the doctrine of spiritual gifts, you will see that tongues passed away in a different way than, say, knowledge and prophecy does. But again, knowledge and prophecy are both issues that are related to the truth. Where tongues was a spiritual gift designed to communicate the gospel in other languages, and in fact, was designed to be a sign to who? Tongues was designed as a sign to the Jews. And so I can easily build a case for you don't need that sign after the Jews go into dispersion in 68 AD. It's done. They had their sign, they had their shot, and they blew it. And so, again, if Paul could heal, why didn't he? My contention is he couldn't. And if Paul couldn't heal, the greatest of the apostles, by his own admission, the greatest of the apostles, then it doesn't appear that anybody else could either. Why would God deny that to Paul and then give it to everybody else? That doesn't make any sense to me. All right, well, continuing on here now. When evening came, after the sun had set, they began bringing to him all who were ill and those who were demon-possessed. Here's one of the things you find out. Once the word gets out that you can do something, people like to have you do it. Oh, now, or duh, actually they don't translate this, it's the coordinating, the hyperordinating conjunction, duh. But now, but or now. Now when evening came, you have here word, this word, opsios, O-P-S-I-O-S. The period of time between late afternoon and dark. And so we translate it, as they do, by the word evening. Obviously, that's a flexible term. It varies. They didn't have daylight savings time, so their evening didn't change. It was always the same, essentially the same time of day. Now, evening having become, aorist deponent participle here, after evening had come, after the sun had set. And here, Mark's not contradicting himself. He's being more specific. When evening came, or literally having, once evening had come, and what does he mean by evening? He's going to tell you the time after sunset is what he means by evening. The sun had gone down. Now, was it completely dark? Well, no. Just as you know, I mean, you can be standing out there on Siesta Key and looking off to the west, and the sun sets, and there's still light for some time after that. Not a long time, but for some time. And so this is the period of time that he's talking about specifically. You got an adverb here, hata, a temporal marker of time, when, H-O-T-E. Whoops, H, that's a rough breathing on there. When had gone down, aorist active indicative of duno, and that word means to go down, and of course we still talk like this. People have their complaints about the Bible. It doesn't use scientific language. Well, what did you really expect Mark to say here? And once the earth had completed its rotations in such a way that the sun appeared to have gone below the horizon, or we can call it sunset. I don't know, people really look for, they're grabbing at straws there. No, they don't, they still talk like that on news. Sunset tonight, they'll have it on Channel 7 if you watch the local news. Well, all of them, I guess, but sunset, sunrise. And we don't get up and say, oh, the weatherman's an idiot. Well, we might say that sometimes. So when had set or gone down, helios, definite article ho, with this term, sun. When the sun had set, imperfect active indicative, and they've rightly supplied here, I think, well, let's see, did they supply it? They supplied the word began because they view this as I did. An ingressive imperfect. Imperfect active indicative. They began bearing or carrying. This is the word pharaoh. To bear something, to carry it, to move it from one place to another. They began bringing to him, preposition pros plus the accusative, masculine singular. To him would be Jesus. All, everyone, all who were ill, the accusative masculine plural, the adjective pos. The ones having, literally, definite article plus the verb echo. And that verb means exactly that, to have or possess something. The ones having ill, literally, or badly. It would be the way you would translate it more literally. Kakos. Whoops. K-A-K-O-S. It's omega, though. Kakos. That word just means badly. The ones having badly, and that's an idiom for those who were sick. Or ill, and they've translated by ill in the New American Standard. All who were ill, and Kai, the ones being demonized. Di menizomai. And this is, again, to have a demon. D-A-I-M-O-N-I-Z-O-M-A-I. The ones being demonized, and as we have pointed out, I will continue to use the language of demon possession. But demonized can run the gamut from a demon just pounding on you, bothering you, to full-blown demons got control of your life. And it runs the gamut. It's a spectrum. And some demon problems are worse than others. We know that believers can become demonized at that level because they began to pay attention to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. And it's because their thinking is compromised. And this is the nature of the beast. This is the nature of the fight. It's all in our thinking. If you win the war up here, you'll win the war. If you lose the war up here, you're going to lose the war. It's just that simple. And it's easy, again, one thing to say, but another thing to fight it out there in the hard realities of the angelic conflict. So the ones being demonized, and so I'll stick with the language they've got here, demon-possessed, but recognize that they may have demonic problems that are not full-blown demon possession, but that demons are bothering them, irritating them, up to and including possessing them. And the whole city had gathered at the door. And as Kai, and then you have a periphrastic construction, the imperfect of I mean. Again, probably here, ingressive. The whole city had begun to gather at the door. Obviously, once they're there, they're there. And then you got episunago is the perfect passive participle. This literally means to go with and then upon is the triple compound you have here. So the whole meaning of it all when you put it together is they were having gathered or having assembled. They began to congregate at the door is the idea of it. The whole is the accusative feminine singular of Halos, H-O-L-O-S, the whole city, Polis, normal Greek word for city with a definite article, Polis, to or toward the door. Pros here would tend to indicate, pros plus the word thura for door. Pros would tend to indicate to me they weren't jamming into the house. They were congregating outside the door. And Jesus essentially begins to work his way out, obviously from the closest, those closest to the door, to those that were further out. Now again, one of the questions becomes, they say, well, this couldn't have happened because of the nature of the streets and that they were close together and everything. Well, you don't know what could happen. And they say, well, the numbers are too big. And again, it's debatable at some level as to what the numbers of these cities were. Some suggest that these cities were no more than 1,000 or 1,500 people. Others have them as much as 15 or 20,000 people. And the fact is, if I had some real sound isagogics that could pin it down perfectly, I would tell you, but I don't. And so my guess is these cities were smaller probably than they thought they were. But at any rate, it doesn't make any difference. One of the things I've observed, like you got, say, in Times Square there. There's plenty of big, broad roads and plenty of places to get together there. But how jammed does that place get at New Year's Eve? How many people can they cram in there? And so it really makes, at some level, no difference how much room there was, as much as how deep they would have been back there, how far back they were. And we're really not told that. We're just told that they crammed in there and got around the door of the house because they knew, by then, they all knew where Jesus was. Now, this also tends to indicate that by the time the sun went down, the word of Jesus had spread and these people had already made their plans. They were headed towards that house the second the sun set. They didn't waste any time. They didn't say, well, we can take him tomorrow. I'm sick. I'm demon-possessed. Help! Well, you'll be all right. Just hang in there for a day. They had their plans and they were right on it. So, verse 34, he healed many who were ill with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he was not permitting the demons to speak because they knew who he was. Again, here, this verse brings up what we call the messianic secret. But it's not a secret so much as the fact that Jesus does not want to cater to the prevailing ideas of his day. So he doesn't use that language of himself, and he doesn't let the demons use it of him. He will prefer, as we will see, the more generic term, Son of Man. Although it's just as heavily messianic as the term Messiah, the Jews didn't get that it was. And so it was a lot less inflammatory for him to use that term. So he healed many who were ill. And as Chi, then you have the verb, aorist active indicative, a therapeuo. Therapeuo, actually. T-H-E-R-A-P-E. And obviously we get our word therapy from this, or therapeutic. To heal or to cure, to restore somebody to health. And he says many who were ill. Doesn't even say he cured all of them. This is another issue that interpreters take issue with. Well, why didn't he cure all of them? Well, he probably didn't have time. I mean, there's a time consideration here. Remember that Jesus is staying at someone else's house. And if Jesus, let's assume Jesus was a normal man who could think, and you're at somebody else's house. Let's say sundown is around, I don't know, let's just pick 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, pick a number. And after 2 or 3 or 4 hours, and Peter's mother-in-law's been sick, we know. Now we know she's healed. But how old she is, we aren't told. And we're not really told that Peter had kids and all of that. But at some point, my contention is Jesus would have put an end to this and said, that's it. I'm done tonight. And so that to me is why it doesn't say he cured them all. He cured many of them because he would have run out of time. Because as a part of showing hospitality and being a good guest, Jesus would have said, these people need to go to bed. And I'm not going to stay up here all night with you people out here surrounding the place and making noise. And, you likely wasn't quiet out there. So he healed many, is polis, the accusative masculine plural adjective. Many having badly, again, the same idiom we saw before, the present active participle with the adverb, echo the verb, with the adverb kakos. Many being sick or ill is the way they've translated in the American Standard. With various diseases. Various is the word poikilos. Diversified, manifold, or various kinds of, and then the dative feminine plural of nosos. N-O-S-O-S. And that word means sickness, disease, or malady. And demons, daimonion, is the word here. You got chi plus d-a-i-m-o-n-i-o-n. And the normal Greek usage has this term, it's understood as meaning a lesser deity. A spiritual being that was somehow between gods and man. Of course, how they viewed it and what they thought was vague, because a lot of the things that came up around this term were just simply human viewpoint. And so they were viewed as lesser deities that existed somewhere between God and mankind. And then in here were the daimonia, the demons. And then here you have men. And now, they didn't necessarily view the daimonion as being hostile or evil or wicked. In Greek usage, at any rate, they didn't. And so there's no suggestion here that they were hostile. The biblical usage, however, is different. This refers to fallen angels. We know what it refers to. These are the angels that attributed or accepted Satan's viewpoint in the angelic conflict, came under his darkness, and voluntarily used their volition to rebel against God. So this word, demons, is fine for us, but you need to know what demons are. Obviously, we hopefully would know by now. But the first century Jew, they likely had a bunch of misconceptions about this based on whatever, however much Roman and Greek thought had influenced them. So the biblical usage is, again, almost always universally referring to fallen angels. And he cast out demons many. Polis is the qualifying adjective here. And then the verb cast out is ekbalo. E-K-B-A-L-L-O. That word means to cast out, drive out, or expel. He cast out many demons, and chi, he was not permitting. You got the negative u, and then here is another usage, another nuance of this term, aphiemi. A-P-H-I-E-M-I. This word also, imperfect, active, indicative, he was not permitting, allowing, or tolerating the demons to speak. He was not permitting to speak. You have this complementary infinitive that completes the thought of what he was permitting, or in this case, what he was not permitting. He did not allow to speak the demons, daimonion again, but with a definite article, accusative, neuter, plural. Because here, Hadi introduces the explanation for why, what his thinking was, because they knew a pluperfect active indicative of oida. They had already previous knowledge. This is why he uses the pluperfect here. Oida is almost always used in the perfect tense anyway. Because it's a verb of knowing. And again, you have gnosko, which varies from oida, in that gnosko can have the nuance of figuring something out or finding something out any of that sort of thing, or learning it. Whereas oida focuses on the content of the knowledge. Once you learn it, you know it. Once you figure it out, you know it. And the demons already knew him, as all it says here. It doesn't say they knew who he was. You don't have a verb here, a discrete verb. Because the demons already knew him, i.e., the New American Standard does communicate, they knew who he was. And okay, I'm not up to any more today, so we're going to just stop there. We'll be ready to dive into this Wednesday. Hopefully my throat will be a little better. And we'll continue on here with the Jesus MO in dealing with these demons and the people that were sick and how this all works out. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to come together and to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.